Welcome to the New Line Podcast.
Our show is a conversation with experienced software engineers where we discuss new technology, career advice, and help you be amazing at work. I'm Nate Murray.
And I'm Amelia Wattenberger, and today we're talking with Redux.js maintainer Mark Erickson. Mark has been maintaining the Redux library for about 5 years and has written an amazing amount of documentation and guide material. Redux is used in the majority of React apps, but folks have recently been questioning, is Redux still a tool I should use in 2020? It depends.
We tease apart all the different use cases for Redux: data fetching, caching state, avoiding prop drilling, and we compare it to other tools in the ecosystem: Apollo, MobX, Recoil, Hooks, and others. In this wide-ranging conversation, we cover the history of Redux, tooling you can use to make your Redux code cleaner, and future plans. We hope you enjoy listening as much as we enjoyed talking to Mark. Maybe we could just start off a little bit by talking about, I guess, Redux in history. I think that actually a lot of our listeners have probably used it and have a passing familiarity with it. So I think we can maybe skip over sort of the like super basics, but I think it might be helpful to track the train of thought of like, where did Redux come from and what sort of problems is it trying to solve?
And I think that's an excellent question. And I think it's something that people really ought to ask for almost any tool that they're using. Knowing why a tool exists, what kinds of problems it's trying to solve, and the context around its creation tells you a lot about how you can use it. Is it worth using? Does it solve my problems at all? I'm not saying you necessarily need to spend hours doing a deep dive into the history of every tool you use, but it is a good thing to evaluate tools in the context for which they were created. So, brief-ish history lesson. React came out 2013. A year later, Facebook announced this thing called Flux. And it was really a response to like your backbone style application architectures, where you had a bunch of individual model instances. And these were very, very event trigger based. So if I called backbone.set first name Mark or something, and that value had changed, the backbone model had event capabilities built in, your standard event emitter stuff. And it would trigger a change first name event and a change, just anything at all, changed event. And the UI code would usually be listening for those kinds of change events to know it needed to redraw itself. And so what Facebook said was, we've tried building apps with this kind of a event trigger model based approach. And what we found is it's really hard to keep track of how event A triggers event B, triggers event C, is listened to by this bit of UI, is cascaded to another model over there, and it just bounces all over the app, and we can't keep track of how the application is actually updating itself at all.
And I feel like this model, there's even a couple generations before this, which would be like, originally we were using jQuery and there was like not really any sort of standard for data architecture. And then maybe you had sort of early AngularJS day where they had two-way data binding, which in you start using it right away and you're like, this is amazing. I don't have to do anything. My app just updates by magic. But then you get that same sort of cascade, which is like one thing changes over here and then the rest of your app cascades and you have like no idea what's going on. And so yeah, I feel like even Flux was maybe a third or a fourth generation in that process.
So what they announced was really more a notional architecture rather than a concrete library. They said, okay, if we centralize the logic in one place and any part of the UI has to, it's still kind of event-based, you're describing something that happened, but it all has to go through one central location. And in original Flux, they had what they called individual stores. So these were kind of class-ish like things, but more like singleton class-ish like things. So you'd have a users store, a posts store, a comments store. And the singleton dispatcher would kind of give each of them a chance to respond. And then the UI could subscribe to poststore.change or something. Redux, it's like over the next year, 2014 to 2015, the community took this idea and ran with it. We had seemingly dozens of Flux libraries coming out every other week, mostly named after really bad Back to the Future jokes, McFly and other stuff. And they all had the same basic idea, but different implementations and different approaches. Redux was originally intended to be just another Flux architecture implementation with a couple of unique spins. And the driving factor was Dan wanted to demo this idea called time travel debugging at a conference, except that he hadn't built it yet and he didn't know how to do it. And he also wanted to apply some functional programming principles to Redux. And so what he and Andrew Clark figured out was, wait a minute, we can replace these individual stores with just functions, and they don't even have to hold the state. They can just take a state and an action and spit out a result. And next thing you know, you've got reducers. And Redux ended up winning the Flux Wars, killed off every other Flux library out there. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. I won't dig into that one too much further. But the net result is that by mid-2016, Redux had really killed off the rest of those. And people had immediately started saying it has to be used with React. Like, if you're using React, you must use Redux. And it really, and things just kind of cascaded from there. Now you had beginner tutorials saying, you know, first set up your Webpack, then set up your Babel, install React, install Redux, you know, 30 pages of tutorial later.
I'm pretty sure I've written that tutorial.
And so, like, what Redux was really trying to solve was answering the question of when, where, why, and how did my state update in my application, and making those updates more predictable by putting as much of your code as possible in pure functions that are easy to test, reducers. And that was the problem space in 2015. Well, it's 2020. The ecosystem has changed dramatically. React is different. Redux is different. There's other tools in the ecosystem. And so what I'm seeing now is the problem space has really changed. It's not how do I manage my state? It's how do I handle data fetching, which is similar and overlaps, but it's not exactly the same thing. There's a lot of people out there who are really just looking to say, let me supply a URL, and I just want to know data and is loading as results. They don't care how it happens, how it's stored, just do some magic behind the scenes. Give me some data. Maybe I need to post an update back to the server, maybe not. But for the most part, I just want to fetch some data and be done with it. There was a really good quote that I saw from the Redux issues relatively early on, where someone said that Redux is a platform for developers to be able to build their own customized state management while reusing things like middleware and the debugging tools. In that sense, Redux is kind of a jack of all trades. You can use Redux to cache server-side state, but it doesn't include anything for it. You can use Redux to track form state, like literally what is the context of this text input. It's probably not that great at that, and we actually advise against doing that these days. You can use Redux to handle very complex state updates on the client. And that means there's also a lot of overlap with other tools that are more specialized for different use cases, you know, whether it be, you know, Apollo or React Query focused on the data fetching, or, you know, maybe a, you know, Formic or something for form state, or even just, you know, built-in React context for the purpose of passing down some data without passing as props through every level. So there's all these different things that you can use Redux for, but there's other tools that are probably more purpose-built for the specific use cases that partially overlap with that. So, you know, picture a Venn diagram. Here's all the things you can do with Redux, and here's your data caching, here's your form state, here's your et cetera, et cetera. So it all overlaps in some way. So where we get into, is Redux even still valuable? I know we weren't totally going to go there, but Redux still is really good at answering the question, when, where, why, and how did my state update? And can I do so predictably and know what's going to happen? If that's the problem you have, Redux is a great tool for that. If you have other problems, Redux might be useful, but there are probably some other tools that may be more specialized for that job.
For someone who is an experienced developer, but maybe new to React, at what point would you advise them to start looking into Redux? Is that right away when they're building a React app that maybe could use Redux?
No. Our standard recommendation is that beginners should focus on learning React by itself first and only try to pick up Redux once they're already comfortable with React. And there's really several reasons for that. One is simply that there's a lot of new terms and concepts and ways of thinking involved in both React and Redux. And if you try and learn them both at once, you're probably going to get overwhelmed with too many new ideas and concepts at once. So by focusing on first React and then Redux, you're just limiting the amount of damage and the amount how overwhelmed you're going to be. Another factor is that once you're comfortable with React and you start to look at Redux, it's easier to see what is the difference between these two tools. Like, this concept is React, that concept is Redux. And you start to see how the pieces can fit together and how Redux might be useful in a React app at all. Whether it's useful in your React app depends on what you're trying to do. But at least as far as learning, we advise trying to split them up. And that actually kind of frustrates me that a lot of, say, like people going through a boot camp are, they're getting, 6 weeks of JavaScript, 4 weeks of React, 2 weeks of Redux, here you go. And it's like, please, that's not helpful. I understand the principle is to try to get people up to speed on real world technologies as quickly as possible, so they at least, are marketable. But in terms of learning, I really don't think it's doing anyone a great service.
Right. It's interesting how Redux's success was in a lot of ways bad for it, right? A lot of people are jumping in way too early when it's not necessary or not appropriate, and then getting overwhelmed. And then they're like, oh, I never want to use Redux ever again, just because they used it without understanding exactly what problem it's trying to solve.
Yeah. And part of being a beginner is you don't have that kind of information. Like, some tutorial tells you you need Redux, or even some senior programmer tells you you need to use Redux, and you don't know enough to ask questions. You're just like, okay, I'm supposed to use this thing. How do I use this thing? You're not thinking about why you need it. And that's really part of the learning process. And it's something I think everyone kind of needs to figure out for themselves along the way.
Yeah, I think a good question when you have a new tool that you like don't quite understand the why is to just, you can ask, say, like, well, what's the consequence if I don't have this? Like, if I didn't use this tool, then what would happen? And a lot of time that can be really insightful into like what the solution is.
I mean, Tyler McGinnis wrote an excellent article called Why React Hooks, which kind of does the same thing I just did in talking about, like, why were they created? What problem are they trying to solve? And the React docs did some of that too with the introduction to hooks. So it's a really valuable exercise to try to look at. Like, what is my problem? What are the tools that even look like they might be useful? And then getting a sense of, does this tool actually even solve my problem in the first place? And why is this tool around?
So one of the reasons I feel like Redux did so well in the beginning is because the core idea was so simple. You watch Dan sit down on video and explain like this core idea of Redux, and you're just like, oh, that is so simple. And you can get so much power out of this. And then what happens is you start to use it in your app, and the reducers grow and grow, and the actions grow and grow, and then you need action creators, and then you need selectors, and there's all this boilerplate, and you feel like, why am I having to rewrite this exact same logic over and over and over? And I think there's maybe actually a lot of people who their complaint with Redux, either in the beginning, is they tried it, they had all this boilerplate, and they're like, ah, this is too much, and they just move on. But you actually have done a lot of work in this space. There's been a lot of progress. Maybe could you talk a little bit about how Redux, or at least the ecosystem around it, is makes Redux easier to use than ever before?
Sure. With a lot of pleasure. I will happily talk about them. Really, since the beginning, boilerplate has been the standard complaint. And Dan wrote a tweet fairly early on where he said that Flux and Redux are not meant to be the shortest, fastest way to update code. It's meant to be clear and predictable. And you will see people say that the predictability and some of that boilerplate is a good thing because you know exactly what the steps are going to be. But in all honesty, there is a lot of extra code that you're going to see in most Redux apps that is a pain to write. And the more code you're writing, the better the chance is that you're going to make a mistake. Standard example would be in Redux, reducers are supposed to do immutable updates. Okay, let's say you've got a state that has, you know, an object nested two or three levels deep and an array. In order to update that, you've got to object your spread your way through three or four nested fields. You've got to map the array, return the item and the unchanged items unchanged, and then spread and copy the one item you actually do want to update. It's a royal pain. It's really easy to make mistakes. And in fact, accidental mutations are the number one mistake that most people make while writing Redux code. And a lot of that just has to do with JavaScript. JavaScript is meant to be a mutable language by default, so you have to do work to make things immutable. Other common things, like you don't have to write action creators. You could just write your action objects inline by hand every time. You don't have to write, you know, const add to do equals capital add to do, etc. But there are good reasons why those patterns existed. Like you're trying to avoid typoing a string if you use it in more than one place, using action creators so that the component doesn't have to know it's dispatching an action, it's just calling a function. There's good reasons for this.
Yeah, if you use TypeScript, the Visual Studio can like infer the types and help autocomplete there.
Right. But a lot of that is what I refer to as incidental complexity. It's not necessary for the purpose of actually using Redux. Redux does have some inherent complexity. Just the fact that you are dispatching an action is a level of indirection because you're not just saying, you know, my data.value equals 123. There's separation there. And that is part of Redux's design. But like all the nested spreads and everything, like those aren't required to use Redux other than the fact that you need to make an immutable update. So we've had a docs page on reducing boilerplate literally since the library came out. And it's got some examples of how you can write your own functions to deduplicate things and so on. And the community built hundreds of libraries to help try and simplify that. And what I was seeing was that there were a lot of very common patterns that were emerging in the way people tried to solve these problems. So I had put up an issue like as far back as 2017, maybe, where I said, like, how can we reduce boilerplate and improve abstractions and make it easier for people to learn and use Redux? And the thread grew to like 150 comments and eventually devolved into people posting links to their own libraries. But the idea hung around, and eventually it turned into an official library that we've dubbed Redux Toolkit. And it went through a whole evolution process of how we figured out the APIs, and there was a name change in there. And I've got a whole blog post that talks about that process. But ultimately, Redux Toolkit is meant to solve a few things. It is an official package from the Redux team. It solves the problems of it is too complicated to set up a Redux store, and I have to go through too many steps. It provides good defaults out of the box. It provides specific small APIs for the most common Redux use cases, and it tries to simplify your code as much as possible. It's also actually written in TypeScript, and we've done our best to design the API in a way that it is very TypeScript friendly and minimizes the number of type declarations that you have to use. So it officially hit 1.0 last fall, and I've been doing my best to advertise it in every Reddit comment that I write. And it's growing rapidly. If you look at the adoption curve for that package on NPM stats, it's basically a nice, steadily growing upward trend, somewhere around 35 to 40,000 downloads a day at this point. Redux itself is like 900,000, a million downloads a day, somewhere in that range. So it's obviously still a small fraction, but that's pretty good adoption right there. And what makes me even happier is seeing other people comment in threads and tweets and whatnot how much they love it and how easier it has made their ability to use Redux without me having to prompt them to say that. So I'm really excited about it. And I've certainly been suggesting that people use it at every chance. And that leads into something else that I've been working on. The Redux docs are good, and most of them were originally written by Dan Abramov. But again, even as far back as 2017, I saw a need to start to try to redo the docs. If we go back and think about the time and the context thing again, docs are written at a certain time by certain people focused on a specific audience. And if you look at the very first page of the Redux Basics tutorial, you'll see something that tells you exactly when that was written, because it says, "Welcome to the Redux tutorial. If you've ever written a Flux app, you'll feel right at home." And in 2020, nobody remembers what Flux even was. And the patterns that are shown in that tutorial are still totally valid. You know, it teaches you what an action is, how to do immutable updates and reducers and everything else. But it shows a lot of those more manual, boilerplate-y kinds of patterns. The Redux docs have been traditionally unopinionated. You know, we say, here's like three different ways you could organize your files, but we're not going to tell you which one's better. That's up for you to decide for yourself. Or like you could split your logic between the action dispatching side and the reducer side, but we're not going to tell you which one's better.
Right. React docs are like that anyway. Mm-hmm.
And I myself have come to more concrete opinions over time. I wrote a lot of the docs that said, here's options A, B, and C, pick one for yourself. Like the FAQ page does a lot of that. And I've come to a lot of conclusions that certain ways work a lot better over time. So about a year ago, I wrote a new page called the Style Guide. I specifically based it off of the Vue framework docs page of that same name. And it tries to provide a set of recommendations and best practices for here are the ways we think you should probably write your code with some levels of recommendation. Like these are really, really high priority. These are you probably should. And these are useful to have. It includes things like you should use Redux Toolkit for writing your code. You should actually try to put Redux logic for a given feature in one file instead of splitting it across, you know, actions/todos, producers/todos, types/todos, and so on. You should try to put more logic in reducers, that sort of thing. So we now have some official recommendations on how you should do things, but the tutorials didn't reflect that at all. And on top of that, the tutorials are the existing tutorial sequence is very much a bottom up, piece by piece sequence. And a lot of that has to do with that's Dan Abramov's teaching style. If you watch the videos that he did on Egghead or his blog post on the complete guide to use effect, Dan likes to think about things from first principles and work from the bottom up and assemble the pieces at the end. That is a very valid teaching technique, but it doesn't work for everybody. A lot of people just want to know, how do I use this? I want to jump in. I've seen Ryan Flores mention that when he got into web development, he jumped straight into building Rails apps. He didn't know Ruby. He didn't know JavaScript. He just started duplicating what he saw in the examples And he was able to build some real working apps, and eventually the knowledge came later. So one of the things we've been missing in the Redux docs is a top-down tutorial with a focus on how to use this versus how it works inside. So as part of my giant grand plan to rewrite most of the docs, I spent much of the last several months working on a brand new tutorial sequence. I originally dubbed it the Quick Start Tutorial. It eventually grew to 25,000 words spread across 6 pages, at which point I realized this really isn't quick anymore, especially because the first 2 pages are devoted to telling you, here's a bunch of Redux terms, and here's what a Redux app looks like, and you only get to writing code on page 3. So quick start just wasn't accurate anymore. So I asked for some suggestions, and I really liked one of them, which was the Redux Essentials tutorial, which I think still conveys that it's a tutorial, but it's more about what you need to know to use it. And so this actually goes through and it builds out a small kind of pseudo Twitter, Facebook-y social media app where you can add posts and fetch notifications and stuff. And it actually takes a big step in how we teach Redux in a number of different ways. It actually teaches Redux Toolkit as the default way to write Redux logic. It teaches our React Redux Hooks API as the default way to interact with Redux from your React components. And it teaches the principles like using a single file for any given feature, putting more logic in the reducers, and so on. So I'd worked on that on and off for the last 6 months. My first attempt wasn't working out right, so I gave up on that one. I spent like a month reading through dozens of other tutorials and taking notes on how they did things and ideas I wanted to steal for these docs. Got interrupted for a month by putting out a new release of Redux Toolkit. And then this whole work from home virus thing happened, and I haven't always felt like working on stuff. But I finally completed that a week ago and published it live, and I'm thrilled about it. There's a lot of info in there, probably too much info, but I'm really, really hoping that this is going to make it a lot easier for a lot of people to use Redux.
One of the things you mentioned is you say, in these docs, we talk about the React Redux API, the React Redux hooks. I actually don't know that a lot of people recognize that Redux isn't so tied to React. Have you looked at Redux? Like, have you worked at all on Redux for any of the other web frameworks?
So, as you said, Redux is its own completely independent standalone JavaScript library. You can use Redux by itself without any UI. You can use it with any UI framework, React, Angular, Emberview, jQuery. I've seen a jQuery Redux bindings layer. It exists.
Yeah. I once wrote my own like Redux for Unity in like C# because I just needed it within an app. Yeah.
But the vast majority of Redux users are using React, and somewhere around half of all React apps are using Redux, conversely. Redux was designed to work with React from day one. And so the React Redux bindings library is the only one that the Redux team officially maintains. All the others have been built by other folks from the other communities. So I have not gotten hands-on on any of those. I've occasionally glanced at them just to see how other people have built things on their end. Ultimately, the bindings layers are all doing basically the same thing. They subscribe to the store, they wait for something to change, and they give you a way to say, when this bit of data changes, redraw my UI. So it's the same basic principle. It's just a question of how it's implemented for any given framework.
Another thing you said is you said, I've been doing my best to advertise, the new docs in every Reddit comment that I write. You are ridiculously active in terms of like helping other people on like Twitter, on Reddit, on Stack Overflow. Like, tell us a little bit about that. Like, how did you come to make that your mission, and tell us what that's like?
That's a very polite way of saying I spend too much time on social media.
That's not what I'm implying, but
it's accurate. I mean, I got involved with Redux really by accident. I started learning React myself in mid-2015, which was entirely coincidentally right when Redux came out. I started working in the Reactiflux chat channels, which is a React-focused set of discussions. And I just spent time lurking, reading blog posts, trying to learn. It eventually got to the point where I'd see questions that I knew the answers to, and I'd answer. And then it's like, oh, hey, I saw a blog post about that the other day. Let me go look in my history and find the link. And then I kept pasting the same links, so I made a list, and then the list kept growing. And then I volunteered to write the FAQ page for Redux, and then I got the commit rights, and then Dan handed the keys to Tim Doerr and myself. It all snowballed, and it was all completely accidental, and it was never a thing I meant to do. And I really didn't even consider myself an actual maintainer until late 2016, probably. And honestly, on top of that, like, if you'd asked me, even up through 2015, et cetera, if I had anything useful that anyone would care about at all, I would have said no. I have nothing interesting for the community to listen to. But somewhere in that, you know, 2016, 2017 time range, I started to become more confident that I did actually know what was going on with this tool, and that I even had permission to say this is the way something ought to work. Even after Dan gave me commit rights, like, for months, all I did was like help close out issues and answer questions. I don't think like I ever made really like a conscious decision that this was something I was trying to do. I have always liked sharing information that I know. And it just sort of became a natural thing. Like, hey, I know this about this tool. Let me try and answer. At some point, it did become very deliberate, especially once we started seeing kind of these waves of backlash against Redux on social media. And it has been, you know, frankly depressing at times. I self-identify with the tool that I maintain to a large extent. And so seeing people bash it it feels somewhat personal at times. But I don't want everyone to use Redux. I will freely say Redux is overused. Not everybody should use Redux. I just want people to take the time to think about what tool is the best fit for their use case. I mean, would I like people to use Redux? Sure. But I just want people to make informed decisions and choose whatever is actually best for their situation. And in a lot of cases, what this means is trying to clarify how stuff actually works, why you would use it, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so that has become a little bit of a one-man mission, I guess.
What are some of the like top criticisms people have about Redux? Like, the only one that I know is like boilerplate, in which we talked about.
That's the most common one. Tool X has killed Redux. Fill in any other popular tool in the ecosystem at this point. Apollo, Context, GraphQL, MobX, XState, Hooks,
whatever. Let's talk about all of those, because I want to dig into actually all of those as much as you're interested. Because I do feel like that is maybe a common misconception, which is like, well, if you use Apollo, you don't have to use Redux. That's not true, but maybe we could talk about that a little bit. Maybe actually you could talk about that. Like, tell us, I assume you've used Apollo some.
I actually have not. There's a chance I may wind up using it on my current work project in the not too distant future. Now, I do spend a stupid amount of time reading discussions about different tools. So I know way more about, you know, Apollo and MobX and everything else than I probably should for the fact that I've never written a line of code with them. But so what it really comes down to is what we were saying earlier about use cases and specialization. So things you could use Redux for: server-side data caching, UI state, form state, you know, complex state management on a client. Apollo is a specialized data fetching and caching tool with the assumption that you're using a GraphQL API. And Apollo does a bunch of stuff for you. Apollo manages sending a GraphQL request. So it takes your GraphQL query, sends the post command, takes the response back. It maintains a normalized cache of the data. If you make the same request more than once, it checks to see if it has that in the cache and hands it back to you. It maintains the loading state for all that data. And ultimately, as a user, you just kind of say, here's my query. Is it loading? It's done. Here's the data. Do stuff with it. If the primary thing that you were using Redux for was as a cache of server fetched data, well, Apollo fits that use case better because it's a purpose-built tool that does that in a very powerful kind of way. So if you have a GraphQL API and you choose to start using Apollo client or you know other similar tools like Urkel or something, you probably don't need Redux for that anymore. And if basically all you were doing was the server and fetched caching, then, well, you don't need Redux at that point because that use case has been fulfilled. A lot of people chose to use Redux early on because it allowed you to avoid prop drilling, passing data through as props through every level of the component tree. And Redux has always used React's context API under the hood. What most people don't realize is that it does so by passing down the Redux store via context so that components can subscribe individually instead of passing the current value through context. And so when the newer React Context API came out, the old one had a bunch of flaws. When the new React Context API came out, React now has a built-in tool whose only purpose is to make a value accessible to some portion of your component tree without having to pass it down as props. And so if that's the only thing you were using Redux for was to avoid prop drilling, there's now a tool that's built in for that. If you prefer a more object-oriented state API where there's more magic under the hood, like I just want to say object.value equals 123 and have my UI magically update without having to worry about writing the code that makes that happen, MobX is a great tool for that. If you are really focused on trying to write state machines for your logic, so you know my data fetching is idle, okay, it's pending, now it's in one of these states, or you know your stoplight or something like that, you can write state machines in Redux reducers, but you actually have to do that yourself. You have to do the checks to say if I am in state A and this event comes in, then I go to state B. Whereas something like XState is purpose-built for the goal of defining a state chart and generating the logic to manage that automatically. So you can use Redux for any one of these things, but there are other tools that are more specialized for that. So you can use Apollo and Redux or React Query and Redux together. And you know, the main reason to do that would be like if you have a bunch of server caching and you have some complex client-side state management going on, then you would use the two tools for their appropriate purposes. But if you just have the one use case of data fetching and you want to use this other tool, then you probably don't need Redux anymore at that point.
Yeah, within Newline, I use both Apollo and Redux for that reason, which is like Apollo is just so easy to connect to our GraphQL API, but you know, you can do like local data manipulation with Apollo, but it's not straightforward at all. It's just much easier to just use Redux. Redux is predictable. There's an ecosystem around it. It's actually easier to use both of the tools within one app than to just like pick one. On this topic of data fetching, what sort of like tools do you recommend for doing data fetching with Redux? I've noticed you've been talking a lot about like thunks with Redux. Is that typically how you would do it? And maybe you could take a step back and talk about like what thunks Sure. are, how they're used, and if that's for data fetching. Yeah.
So a Redux store by itself is pretty small. And the only things it knows how to do are get the current state, dispatch an action, and subscribe to the store. So after an action has been dispatched, just let me know that process is done. All that is 100% synchronous. If I call store.dispatch increment, it's going to run the reducer, loop over all the subscribers, run every subscriber function until they're done, and then return. So any asynchronous behavior has to happen separately. If you look at the Redux counter vanilla example, you can see some plain JavaScript examples of like doing like a set timeout and then a dispatch inside. But in a real application, we're probably going to want to do some async logic that interacts with the store, but we're not supposed to import the store into the rest of our code base. It's like injected at runtime through the React components. So how can you write logic that is async and interacts with the store when you don't even have a store to work with yet? So Redux was designed from the beginning to be extensible, and the extensibility pattern that it uses is middleware, much like you would see in, say, an Express application. So middleware forms a pipeline around the dispatch function. So if you have a store that has been configured with three different middleware, and you call store.dispatch, it's actually going to run through middleware A, middleware B, middleware C, and then the real store. And any middleware can do anything it wants with whatever's coming down the pipeline. It can log it, it can delay it, it can modify the action, anything at all. So middleware was intended to be a plug-in point where you could choose how to modify the store to support some kind of asynchronous behavior. And so a lot of the Redux ecosystem, especially early on, was people creating different kinds of side effect middleware that allows you to do async logic and interact with the store using different syntaxes. So one of the things during the early design between Dan Abramov and Andrew Clark was that some of the existing Flux libraries, and there's our history again, had built-in ways to handle async behavior, like dispatching a promise or something. But that was the only way you could do async behavior in those libraries. And Dan and Andrew didn't want to tie people to one specific form of async logic. Like if they'd chosen RxJS, every Redux user would have to learn RxJS in order to do everything, which, I mean, I guess we already see that over in the Angular world these days. But they wanted to make it optional. So the simplest possible async middleware that they came up with during the early development was something that allows you to actually pass a function to dispatch instead of a plain action object. And there is a thunk middleware that just says, hey, is this action object actually not an object, but really a function? If so, I'm just going to call the function, give it access to dispatch and get state, and it can do whatever it wants with it at some point in time. And it kind of acts like a loophole where you can now run asynchronous logic and still have access to dispatch and get state after your async call returns. So thunks became the single most popular form of async middleware. Other common ones are Redux Saga, which uses generator functions, and Redux Observable, which actually does use RxJS inside. Sagas and observables are both incredibly powerful. You can do some very complicated async workflows like that. And I would say that, for example, sagas are great if you need to do some like complex background thread-like behavior. JavaScript doesn't actually have threads, at least on the client. But imagine you want to spin up something that runs in the background, waits for like a user onboarding action to be dispatched, and then shows like the next part of the tour or something like that. Or starts by asking the server to calculate the first 10 items out of 1,000, waits for those to complete, lets the user pause calculating, jump ahead to like item 597, calculate the next 10, whoops, wait, cancel the whole thing. Sagas are great for that kind of use case. Most people don't need to do anything that complicated. They just want to fetch some data and be done with it. And so thunks are basically the simplest possible way to do arbitrary async logic, like an AJAX call, and dispatch some action when it's done. So one of the common complaints about Redux was I have to call apply middleware, I have to add the thunk middleware, I have to configure the dev tools. Redux Toolkit's configure store function automatically sets up the Thunk middleware out of the box, sets up the dev tools. You just make one simple call. Here's my reducer. Done. And it works. So we do now recommend that Thunks are the default syntax for making async calls in Redux. And Redux Toolkit now even includes an API called Create Async Thunk that manages the typical process of dispatch an action before we make the call, and then dispatch either success or failure after the call returns. So you just make your async call, return a promise, and it dispatches those for you. I'll be honest and say that having actually written a tutorial that even uses that new API, it's still clunkier than I would like, especially in comparison to an Apollo or a React query, where it's just, here's my URL, tell me is loading, tell me data. I really didn't want to get to the point of trying to add a more specialized data fetching and caching API into Redux Toolkit, because that's like its own tar pit, and I really didn't want to get stuck in that. And I still don't want to get stuck in it, but that really does feel like the next area we ought to try to explore. I definitely don't want this to be anything as big and complicated as Apollo, but clearly it is still a pain point syntax-wise. It is something that everyone wants to do somehow in their applications. And it is something where I think we could provide some kind of a hopefully lighter weight, but moderately useful built-in tool to try to abstract out that a little more, whether it be... Okay, so here's something. I'm actually at work. I was thrown onto an AngularJS 1 application a few months ago.
Lucky you.
Yeah, I know. I'd managed to avoid ever touching Angular. I never wanted to touch Angular. Any
you thought you got away.
And the project I was reassigned to 3 months ago was a classic mean.js boilerplate repo. And actually, side note, the first thing I did was I converted the build tooling to use Create React App instead of Gulp and everything else. I have like a 6,000 word blog post on that topic because it was too cool to not talk about. But so for the first time, I've been using Angular 1's resource class. So Angular 1 includes its own HTTP library, and you can make your basic GET and POST calls. But there's also a higher level of abstraction called a resource where you say, here's my endpoint, and then I can define my standard REST patterns, GET, PUT, POST, whatever. And it handles a lot of the work for you internally. Other people have written a number of Redux add-ons that do that same kind of thing. So at some point, we're going to sit down and start kind of trying to catalog what is the problem space, how has the community tried to solve this already, and how can we look at libraries like those that are already built for Redux specifically, other libraries like React Query, which are solving the same kind of thing but are React specific, and try to synthesize and steal ideas from all of the above and come up with something that is useful, but hopefully not too hard for us to build and maintain. So it's something we'll look at some point in the not too distant future, depending on when I and some of the other folks in the community have time.
It seems that there's a spectrum between like React and Redux on one end where they're pretty lightweight and they try to be really unopinionated, but that can be really confusing for beginners who just want to get started and they're like, how do I do routing? And then on the other end is a project like Angular or something a little bit heavier where people can jump in right away, but like it's really opinionated. You don't really get to choose how your app is built in a lot of ways. And it seems like both Redux's strengths and its weaknesses are in that it's so flexible. And so I like how you made that Redux toolkit to like step up the ladder a little bit. And it seems like you're going up that ladder a little bit more for folks that might benefit from a little bit less flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're absolutely right that there's strengths and weaknesses with both the pick and choose approach and the here's your entire kitchen sink framework approach. You know, the nice thing about an Angular or an Ember app is that they tell you, here's how you lay out your files. Here's how you write your components. Look, we already have our own HTTP library. Like, just do what we tell you and it'll work. On the other hand, there's a bigger learning curve. Like, I still don't understand how people who are learning modern Angular are supposed to jump straight into TypeScript and RxJS right away. And if you need more flexibility, you may be kind of locked in by those tools. On the other hand, as you said, the strength of the React and Redux ecosystems is that you can pick and choose everything you need just for your use case. The bad news is you're going to have to pick and choose everything for your use case. And so, part of Redux's adoption is that it has been uberly flexible, and people can, like I said, mold and build and customize it for their needs. But that meant that you had to set up everything and choose everything. And there's a lot of decision fatigue involved in that. And so I'm really doing my best to try to find a balance in a minimally productive set of guidelines and APIs that don't obscure how Redux works or the fact that you're using it, but they guide you in the right direction and, you know, eliminate a lot of the busy work.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the hard problems are around just explaining how to use Redux, explaining what it is. And the last time I looked, I haven't looked at it in a while at the repo, but I would assume there's a lot more documentation code or lines of code than there are actual code lines of code.
Oh, yeah. And people have said, and fairly legitimately so, Redux isn't even a library. It's just a pattern that happens to have some really good documentation associated with it. There was a wonderful conference talk by Chung Lo, who's been part of the React, you know, kind of the greater React community for a long time. I think it was ReactConf 2017. He did a talk called On the Spectrum of Abstraction. And his thesis was that there's multiple levels of meaning and ways we can transfer information. There's literally what the language itself lets you do. There's comments and documentation and tutorials and conferences, and they all kind of stack on each other. And like, I can tell somebody this is the right way to use a tool, but maybe the tool itself still lets you do whatever you want. Whereas if the tool forces you to do things a certain way, then that meaning, that concept is embedded in it. Now, his point there was he was making a sales pitch for the ReasonML language, which is a much more opinionated functional programming language. But if you think about it with Redux, the Redux core doesn't actually say you have to write your code immutably. It doesn't say you ought to normalize your fetch data so you can look up items by ID. It doesn't say anything about how you should structure your files and your folders. Those are all extra levels of meaning that we as a community have kind of figured out works probably better than other approaches. And we have to tell people that, but it's not built into the library. So we've got to write docs that tell people this is how you're supposed to use the tool. And there's not a lot of anything actually enforcing that. So there's a lot of documentation, probably because there's a lot of stuff you ought to know about it that isn't built into the tool itself.
The new guy on the scene is Recoil. What are your thoughts on why someone might use Recoil versus Redux, or how they relate to one another?
So I'll be very upfront and say that I really don't know a lot about Recoil at all. I certainly have not tried to use it. I haven't done more. I didn't even watch the conference talk. I've seen.
We could skip it.
Well, no, yeah. we can try it. Third-hand discussion, shall we say? So what I know about it is that it's primarily hooks based. It uses MobX-like observables internally, and it seems like it feels very React-centric or React-native, not in the sense of mobile development, but like it feels almost like it's built into React, even though it is not from the actual React core team. A totally separate team at Facebook built it. My impression is that it offers a very React-y way to deal with state that is spread across components. And even just the fact that it's from a Facebook team, I think, has encouraged a lot of people to try it out. I do find it interesting that it's racked up like 7,500 stars on GitHub, but the current daily downloads is only like 1,500 a day or so, I think, when I looked. So it's clearly attracted a lot of interest, but it hasn't picked up as much adoption as that basic interest has hit so far. And part of that is just it's so experimental.
Yeah, we had Sean Wang on here last week, and one of the things that he talked about is when you're evaluating open source libraries, he was like, I would look for signals that are hard rather than ones that are easy. And so he actually specifically cited that like GitHub stars is very easy. You land on the page, you hit the star, you move on with your life. Whereas like actually looking at usage or hours used or downloads, that's a much more difficult metric to have be created. And so that's an interesting point that you make.
I mean, my sense is that Recoil probably is going to grow significantly over time, and just a gut feeling looking at the use cases that it solves and the general reaction. That may not be for a while, if only because it is still marked as experimental and the team clearly has a lot of work to do on it. But the kind of direction they're going and some of the responses that I see people who have tried it out saying, I think it's probably going to pick up some noticeable market share over time.
I know nothing about Recoil, but I did want to ask about, it seems like most of your future plans for Redux are documentation-based. Are there any code changes planned?
So the Redux core has, in a sense, been done since like 2016. If you look at the actual meaningful code commits to the core library since then, almost nothing. When Redux 4.0 came out, it was really just kind of cleaning up the TypeScript types and changing a few error messages. We did actually have a series of pull requests that converted the core library to be written in TypeScript, actually as far back as last year, and it's sort of been sitting there ever since. The other primary maintainer, Tim Dorr, has been trying to keep an eye on things and is planning to put out a Redux 5.0 release at some point that is basically just the logic converted to TypeScript, but the types will be tweaked some and breaking changes and major version and so on. But in terms of the actual functionality, the core really isn't going to change at this point. Redux Toolkit, I'm very open to adding new APIs, like, you know, some kind of like a REST CRUD data fetching kind of a thing. And maybe even, you know, some kind of a React hook or something built in. Part of the design of Redux Toolkit so far has been that, like the Redux core, it's completely UI agnostic. So I could use Redux Toolkit in an Angular app if I wanted to. But there, you know, maybe we can have like an alternate entry point that has some React hooks inside so that it's not like a forced dependency or something. On the React Redux side, things last year, 2019, was really, really busy because in late 2018, we released version 6, which was an attempt to re-architect React Redux to pass data via context. It was my idea. It didn't work out. I'm sorry. I had good reasons for wanting to do it. I basically thought that's what the React team was telling me to do. It worked. It just didn't work fast enough in practice. So we had to rewrite it again for version 7. And the good news was that enabled us to then put out the React Redux Hooks API last summer. And people love that. And I think that was a huge step forward for React Redux. We've only put out one more minor version since then. And I honestly can't even remember what was in that. There are a few small PRs that have been merged in that have piled up. And I actually literally need to try to put out a new patch release of React Redux this weekend, if I can sit down and remember to take the time to do that. The next likely change for React Redux, the React team has been really big on this idea of suspense and concurrent mode for the last couple of years. And they've said, like, we kind of announced it too early, but it just flat out took longer than we thought it would take to build it. So Redux by design kind of goes against a lot of what concurrent mode and suspense are meant to do. in concurrent mode works best when React can juggle state updates and rearrange them to suit its own purposes. That's not how Redux works. So Redux, in that sense, will never be 100% concurrent mode compatible, but that doesn't mean it can't work at all. And the React team has actually written a new hook, which hasn't been released yet, called Use Mutable Source, which was literally designed from the ground up to work with Redux and other external state management tools to allow them better compatibility with concurrent mode. Not perfect, not ideal, but more than good enough. So my assumption is that sometime after that comes out, and whenever concurrent mode is finally ready, we will look at a React Redux version 8, which would be built around this Use Mutable Source hook as integration with React concurrent mode. I'm not going to put a timestamp on it because I've already sunk way too much time into thinking about concurrent mode. It'll happen when it happens, eventually, when the React team gets that out.
It's really interesting how you say that Redux hasn't really changed at its core since 2016. I feel like Redux is like this really Lindy idea, like that it's going to be around for a long time in web development. It's almost like this pure idea that was discovered as like essential as component-based design itself. And that's really interesting to think of. What are some of these other, I'll have to think about this more, like what are some of these other patterns that have kind of been discovered in web development that we're still going to be using in 10 years, 20 years time?
I think there is a little bit of truth to that. Like if you look at the development history of Redux itself, it was basically like a month and a half to 2 months in the summer of 2015, where two really smart guys took a bunch of other ideas, distilled them to their essence, and came out with something that worked beautifully. And we've learned and we've built on top of that since then, but it was kind of like 2 months of magic. And you can also argue, I think legitimately, that React and Redux is something of like a local optimum, where like if you picture like a hill of progress, we kind of hit a little valley. And it works great. It's way better than anything that came before, but we could, in a sense, kind of get stuck here for a while. And so that's why I think it's great that you do see a lot of other innovation going on. You know, Apollo and React Query pushing data fetching, MobX pushing observables, Recoil trying out something new. It's great that you've got all these other things trying out, and we'll see which ones work out in the same way that we looked at 50 different Flux libraries in 2014, and eventually things kind of coalesced into this. This is clearly a better way to do things. Could you still be using React and Redux 10, 12 years from now? I don't see why not. I mean, if COBOL can last that long, surely these can. Even with the JavaScript ecosystem changing seemingly every day, will there be something probably better? Quite likely. We'll see how it goes.
I love that. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about? I think you've answered everything Nate and I were at least wrote down.
The other main thing at the moment is I am extremely happy to have finally completed that big new tutorial sequence. Thrilled about that one.
Congratulations.
But it's one step out of many. I have this giant master plan for revamping the Redux documentation. Some of it is just shuffling pages around to a newer organizational structure. But I have a lot of other sections that I want to add. For example, the Redux docs have always been, here's your basic tutorial, here's your advanced tutorial, because somehow fetching data is advanced, right? Oh, yeah, okay, have fun, push you out of the nest, bye. And they don't really provide a lot of guidance on kind of building real-world apps. The closest we've got is the recipes section, but it's kind of a very scattered hodgepodge list of ideas. So I do want to add some kind of a real-world usage guides section. Things like, you know, how do I choose what async pattern to use? Stuff along that line. I would also like to add a section on understanding Redux. So the stuff we've talked about earlier, like the history, the context, why does it work that way? What is kind of the mental model for deciding whether to put code where you dispatch the action or in the reducer, or trying to think of good ways to design actions. But the next piece that I'm going to throw myself into is actually rewriting that existing tutorial sequence. It may end up a complete rewrite. We'll see. But my goals, well, several goals. I want to remove outdated references like mentions of flux, because that's completely irrelevant at this point. I want to show simpler patterns, like writing an action object and an action type inline, instead of having to do const add to do equals quote add to do. I want to show things like putting all your Redux logic in a single file. I want to improve the explanations, try and have a bunch of like runnable code sandbox examples, improve the explanation flow. And so hopefully do the same kind of thing for the bottom up how it works, here's all the pieces tutorial that I did for the top down, here's just how to use it, worry about the rest later tutorial. And I'm hoping I can take some of the ideas and pieces that I learned working on this tutorial and apply them to that one as well. I'm hoping I can convince myself to dive into that one in the next few weeks, probably be doing a lot of research and analysis on the content in there to begin with. No guarantees on when I'm actually going to get done with that, especially after how long it took me to do this one. But that's the next piece I plan to dive into. But that also means I'm not working on any of the rest of the rewrite plan that I have. So I continue to beg for help on Twitter. I occasionally get some people saying they would be interested in helping out, and I haven't gotten a whole lot of concrete assistance so far. So hopefully, maybe. If not, I'll continue forward with my little one-man crusade.
I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah. Thank you so much. You've given us so many like great resources and a ton of great insight into Redux. So thank you so much for being with us.
And I appreciate the opportunity to come on.
Hey, you made it to the end.
Yay.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation.
If you have a minute, a review on iTunes would help other people find the podcast. We have a lot of great content coming up. So to be notified of new episodes, hit that subscribe button.